From NPR and WBUR, I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. A new NPR PBS NewsHour Marist poll out today shows Bernie Sanders surging and Michael Bloomberg moving into second place nationally among Democrats, with the Nevada caucuses just 4 days away. The poll means Bloomberg has qualified for his first 2020 debate tomorrow night in Nevada. Let's bring in Democratic strategist Maria Cardona. Hi, Maria.
Hey, Jeremy, how are you?
I'm doing well. And what is at stake tomorrow night? Who's going to have a target on their back?
A lot is at stake tomorrow night, Jeremy. As we have seen, the one thing that we can say about this race is that it is completely unsettled and really is it's anyone's to take at this point. The people that I think are going to have the biggest targets on their back are Bernie and Mayor Bloomberg. And Mayor Bloomberg, because it will be his very first time on the debate stage, and he will have to start really defending his stances, his policies, his record, his past comments in an arena on a forum where he's never had to do that before. And the candidates that he's going to be next to tomorrow night have had to do this for almost up to a year.
Right. Everything we've been seeing from him so far have been either scripted ads or scripted speeches.
That's exactly right. And so I think that every single Democratic candidate should be glad and should be looking forward to this chance to test Bloomberg in a way that they've all been tested. But he has, up until now, has had a free pass in terms of spending millions of dollars and his big money to be able to defend his stances, or not even defend, to message out his stances in the most positive way possible without having had to defend them. And so I think it's a big opportunity for the other Democratic candidates and for Mayor Bloomberg as well.
So let's just talk about what's in this poll. The NPR PBS NewsHour Marist poll shows Sanders at 31, Bloomberg 19, Biden at 15, Warren at 12, Klobuchar at 9, Pete Buttigieg at 8. Remember that Pete Buttigieg and Klobuchar were number 2 and 3 in the New Hampshire primary just now. Is there a path forward for these other moderates in the race at this point, like Klobuchar, Buttigieg, and Biden?
I think that is exactly what the caucuses and the primaries in Nevada and in South Carolina will tell us. I have always said that we should step back and resist portraying or announcing a front runner in this race until you have more diverse states and communities of color really have a chance to weigh in. That is what is happening in Nevada as we speak, and that is what's going to happen in South Carolina later on in the month. We all know that communities of color, African American voters, Latino voters, are somewhat the backbone of the Democratic Party, and no candidate can get to the nomination without majority support within these communities of color. The fact that somebody won either outright or tied in Iowa and in New Hampshire does not tell the whole story. Let's wait until communities of color weigh in, and we will have a much more robust indication of where this race is going.
So President Trump tweeted this morning something that he's been saying for a bit now. He said the DNC is working overtime to take the Democratic nomination away from Bernie Sanders again. He is playing off reports that party leaders are scared that Sanders would lose to Trump in the general election because he's too far to the left. And they're worried that the debate rules, for example, for tomorrow night's debate helped enable Bloomberg to qualify, even though he doesn't have any donors because he's self-funding completely. You're on the DNC Rules Committee. How do you assure Democrats and Sanders supporters in particular that the playing field is fair?
The playing field is absolutely fair. There were some changes, frankly, a lot of changes that were made after 2016 to make sure that the process was transparent, was fair, and everybody knew the rules of the road from the very beginning. And every campaign did know the rules of the road from the very beginning. Everything has been transparent. Everything has been out in the open. Everything has been out on the table, so that not even the perceived notion that this in any way was leaning towards one candidate or the other could be said. Now, having said that, there are a lot of Bernie supporters who, no matter what the DNC does, is not going to have trust in the process. And frankly, I think that's detrimental to Bernie himself and to the whole of the Democratic process. Because I will tell you one thing, Jeremy, if there is one thing that is true in this race, is that no matter who the nominee is, if every single Democrat, including the massive support within the progressive community and independents and disaffected Republicans, don't come and support the nominee wholeheartedly, we will lose to Donald Trump. And what's interesting is that Donald Trump seems to be trying to buoy Bernie Sanders in a way that indicates that he's the one that he wants to run against. But I also think it's Trump, you know, trying to cause chaos,
right,
which is the, you know, his middle name, into the Democratic Party. And we should not let him do that.
That is Maria Cardona, Democratic strategist on the Rules Committee at the DNC. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
There's news today about a deal that could end America's longest war, the war in Afghanistan. The Afghan Interior Minister said today that a reduction in violence between the Taliban and the U.S. is part of a peace deal that will begin in the next 5 days. The news comes as the incumbent president, Ashraf Ghani, declared victory today in a contested election process that has dragged on for 5 months. NPR's Diya Hadid joins us from Kabul. And Diya, does this feel real? I'm just wondering, do people there believe this could actually lead to peace?
We've been interviewing as many ordinary people as we can over the past few days. And it seems people are actually apprehensive about this deal. They've experienced decades of conflict at this point, and the idea that this could wind down nearly seems fantastical. And more than that, some people here feel that the Americans are abandoning them to the Taliban. Others, particularly more liberal women, women who have jobs, women who study, worry that if the Americans do withdraw and there's a political settlement, that might bring the Taliban back into the government, and that might come at their expense. They're worried their rights will be curtailed, they'll be prevented from working or leaving their house without permission, like it was in the 90s when the Taliban ruled. People call this a peace deal. It's not a peace deal. It's a deal between the Taliban and the Americans that will end America's role in this war. It doesn't mean the war's going to end. It doesn't mean that peace is going to come to Afghanistan. That's a whole other process. And one of the really frightening things is that the fate of 30 million people might be forgotten once American boots leave this land.
I want to ask you more about the government's role. We heard from the Afghan Interior Minister today, but as I understand it, the Afghan government has not been involved in this peace process. That seems like a problem.
It is a problem, but the Taliban consistently refuse to allow Afghan government officials onto the negotiating table because they don't recognize them. Now, government officials have tried to put a positive spin on this. They say the Americans have promised they won't abandon the security forces or abandon the government. And they say the Taliban is at least willing to negotiate with them in some form. And they say that in itself is progress.
I understand the Taliban leader, Abdul Salam Hanafi, shared a video message soon after this announcement. What is the Taliban saying?
Right. So this video was shared yesterday, and it was a 3-minute video, and Hanafi was saying that he expects a deal to be signed by the end of the month. But even in that video, you can start seeing the contours of some of the problems that are going to emerge. Because, for instance, he said he expected Taliban prisoners to be released after a deal was signed, and that should happen before the Taliban begin negotiations with the Afghan government and Afghan officials on a political settlement. We haven't heard anyone else talk about the release of Taliban prisoners at this point. And so what we have at this point, the Americans are saying something, the Taliban are saying something else, and there's crossover between them, but they're not all singing from the same book. And so there's going to be a lot, I think, of new details that are going to emerge in the next few days and weeks. And that does bring up the potential for misunderstandings between the Americans and the Taliban and government officials. There could be fresh violence that upturns this. So it's really important to remember at this point that this deal is complicated and its details are finicky. And there's a lot of possibilities for this to go wrong at any point in time.
I want to bring back up something that we mentioned earlier, and that's about Ashraf Ghani's victory. This was a contested election. Do you feel in any way that this will help matters?
Not really. Because this was a contested election, it means that his rivals haven't recognized that he's won. At least they hadn't yesterday when we last spoke to them. And we're waiting for fresh comment from his rivals now. And if Ashraf Ghani doesn't have that legitimacy, it's going to be so much harder for him to lead a negotiating process with the Taliban. And that process is key to bringing peace to Afghanistan. It's not just American forces withdrawing that will bring peace for 30 million people who've lived through decades of conflict. It's that Afghans themselves have to agree on a political future for this country. And if Ashraf Ghani doesn't have the legitimacy to do that, it makes that deal so much harder to pull off.
You mentioned that there's so many steps that we have to see taken over the next few days and weeks. But in theory, once the U.S. and Taliban sign this deal, what's expected to happen later this month?
What we expect to happen is the beginning of some phased withdrawals from around the country. But we don't know yet how those withdrawals will happen, how they'll be measured, where those forces will go. Will they leave the country? Will they regroup in other bases? We don't know at this point what will happen to NATO forces. All those tricky details just haven't been made public. And one of the chief grievances of Afghan officials when we speak to them off the record is that they just haven't been keyed in on what this deal will look like, how it will play out day to day.
That's NPR international correspondent Dia Hadid in Kabul. Thank you so much.
The country hit harder than just about any other by the 2008 financial crisis is finally getting its groove back. Greece just hit a milestone last week. Its 10-year bond yield fell below 1% for the first time ever. For comparison, Greek bond yields soared to nearly 45% during the crisis. And the country has faced years of austerity since then. The low yields mean investors have confidence that lending money to the government of Greece is not that risky. Joining us now from Athens is independent journalist John Syropoulos, who writes the New Athenian blog. Hi, John.
Hello, Jeremy.
Well, let's start with that bond yield. Does that indicate that there is more investor confidence now in the state of the Greek economy?
It's the culmination of a long drop in the Greek bond yield, which really started quite dramatically in March of 2019, when the election was announced for July. And in that period, the Greek 10-year bond interest fell from about 4.5% to, well, at the end of January, the government sold a 15-year bond for the first time in the last decade for interest of 1.9%. And you can see that in a very short period, just 2 weeks later, it managed to sell a 10-year bond for below 1%. So yes, I think it is very much the markets stepping out in front of the credit rating agencies, stepping out in front of Greece's creditors, the institutional creditors like the International Monetary Fund and the European Union, the Eurozone, and saying, we have confidence in this economy. We can see that Greece is sustaining a path back towards growth, and we want to be ahead of the curve and make some money out of this, because eventually Greek interest rates will be below inflation.
So it sounds like a large part of that may just be confidence in this new government. Greece has a more centrist government now, the New Democracy Party. The prime minister there is Kyriakos Mitsotakis, taking over for the leftist Syriza party, which had been in power for many years.
That is very true. And the conservatives, the New Democracy Party, made no secret about the fact that they really wanted to push ahead on economic reform and drive Greece towards prosperity rather than redistribution of wealth and helping out the poor and the destitute, all of which New Democracy maintains is important. But after a 10-year decline that claimed a quarter of the economy, you have to increase the size of the economy again. So they are banking on clean energy projects, construction projects, which have been stalled during the 4 years of the left-wing Syriza government. And of course, they're trying to reverse the brain drain that saw approximately 500,000 young educated Greeks. Those are the latest figures to emerge from the industrial, the Hellenic Federation of Industry, that 500,000 people between the ages of 25 and 40 left the country during those years of recession. They're trying to get those people back to add value to the economy again. So yes, it is a vote of confidence in the New Democracy government, And they have come through on a lot of what they said they would. I mean, just in a period of 6 months, they passed 32 pieces of legislation in Parliament. Hmm. That is quite a track record for the Greek legislature. But a lot still remains to be done.
John Syrapoulos, I want to ask you one more thing, which is that Greece's neighbor, Turkey, is very active right now on the world stage. It's involved in Syria. It's involved in Libya. Greece and Turkey are both NATO allies. But is Athens especially anxious right now about what President Erdogan is doing, where he's taking Turkey?
There is a lot of anxiety about what is seen here as Turkish provocation in the eastern Mediterranean, Turkey sending drill ships and oil and gas exploration ships into Cypriot exclusive economic zone waters, and Turkey threatening to do the same in waters that Greece says form part of its exclusive economic zone. And the United States and the European Union have repeatedly called on Turkey to stop what they call illegal drilling activities and have asked Turkey to refrain from doing the same thing in the Aegean or east of Crete, where apparently there are promising areas to explore in. But it's been going on for some time, and these are two countries that have learned to live with tension and with clashing territorial claims. So I don't think that tension is at a level where it could disrupt the economy of either country at this point.
That is John Syrapoulos in Athens. He writes the New Athenian blog. John, thanks as always.
Thank you, Jeremy.
To Colorado now, where for the first time, college students there will be able to earn a bachelor's degree in cannabis biology and chemistry. Colorado was the first state in the United States to legalize recreational marijuana back in 2012. And educators at Colorado State University Pueblo say this new major was created after students expressed an intense interest in the field. Joining us now via Skype is David Limpool. He's the dean of the university's College of Science and Mathematics. Dean, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
So you make the distinction that this is not a, quote, marijuana degree, but a science degree. Explain more by what you mean.
So this degree is really a rigorous degree. It's almost a double major in chemistry and biology. And so students who go through this degree will be well prepared for a lot of different areas in the sciences, not necessarily just cannabis. So we've got possibilities of students working in chemistry labs or biology labs or natural products labs. They might go on to graduate school. And so to do that, they've got to take a lot of rigorous, difficult classes.
I want to talk, though, a little bit more about the cannabis part of it, because Colorado has a booming system and an economy that has really seen growth because of the cannabis industry with the legalization of marijuana. We'll get to that in just a moment. But what kind of response has the university received from this degree program, from students and the like?
It's been received really well. We've had an almost overwhelming response ever since it was passed by the Colorado Commission on Higher Education. And so I've been fielding inquiries almost nonstop since the announcement came out. And there's definitely a demand.
Yeah. Universities of Michigan and North Dakota offer bachelor's degrees in medicinal plant chemistry, and the University of Maryland has a related master's program. What differentiates your program, or is it similar?
There are some similar aspects to them. One of the differences in this program is the interdisciplinary biology and chemistry nature of the degree. All students will be taking core courses in both chemistry and biology, and the opportunity to have an emphasis on the natural product side or on the analytical side is different than what's currently out there.
Yeah, I can't help but think about our history in the United States with our relation to cannabis and hemp. This isn't the first go-round in this field of study. I mean, I'm reading that cannabis was used medicinally for generations before it was outlawed in 1937. Virginia actually passed a law in 1619 requiring hemp to be grown on every farm in the colony to make things like rope and sails. I'm just wondering from you, do you see this wave of academic study as sort of a way to destigmatize perhaps what we put to the idea of marijuana and kind of our perceptions on marijuana and hemp and cannabis?
Yeah, it has gone around. One of the things that is a little bit different, I think, now than in when it was used previously is the state of science and the state of technology is a lot more advanced now than it was. And so I think there's an opportunity as scientists for studying the plant and studying all of the different aspects related to not only the human body, but also with respect to industrial hemp and what kinds of uses the plant might have with phytoremediation and some of the kind of creative applications of the cannabis plant is something that may have more longevity than previously. It's not just about getting high. In fact, students in the program won't be working with anything that's high, you know, THC. So there's a lot to the whole industry and to the plant itself that's different than it was 100 years ago.
More states have followed Colorado and Washington State's lead in legalizing either recreational or medicinal marijuana, but it's still illegal on the federal level. I'm just wondering from you, what kind of impact could academia play in pushing to legalize it federally?
Hopefully the academia won't be pushing one way or the other. That's one of the things that I've been trying to emphasize. We're not pro-cannabis or anti-cannabis. We're all about the science of cannabis. And so there could be just as much science that comes out that says that its dangers and its the negative properties outweigh any of the benefits as the other way around. We really don't know. I think there's been some research that has been done, but there's an awful lot of research yet to go. And hopefully as scientists, you were looking at it from a strictly scientific, non-biased point of view. So we really are not trying to legitimize cannabis in any way. We're saying that the industry is here. It's being legalized both in recreational forms as marijuana, but also from the hemp standpoint. And we think it's a responsibility to educate scientists to kind of fight through some of the pseudoscience that's out there.
That's Professor David Limpool. He is the Dean of the College of Science and Mathematics at Colorado State University, Pueblo. Professor, thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Jeff Bezos, the world's richest man, announced this week he is donating $10 billion of his personal fortune to fight climate change. Known as the Bezos Earth Fund, which Bezos announced over Instagram yesterday, it is thought to be one of the largest philanthropic gifts ever. For more, let's bring in Mike Regan, senior editor at Bloomberg News. Hi, Mike.
Hi, Jeremy.
So Bezos in the past has been criticized for not doing that much in the way of philanthropy. In fact, we just talked to the CEO of Airbnb, another billionaire, and I asked him whether he thinks Bezos should be giving more money to charity, and apparently now he is. He's pledging 8% of his personal wealth to fight climate change. Why this new commitment?
Well, all we really know about his motivation so far is just a caption on an Instagram picture of the Earth. And it's only about 125 words. But what he says basically is in part that climate change is the biggest threat to our planet. And he says he wants to work alongside others both to amplify known ways and to explore new ways of fighting it. Now, with that said, I would point out that Bezos has come under a lot of pressure, even and especially from employees within Amazon itself. Since when you think about it, delivering all those Amazon packages obviously has a big impact on the environment. So he's heard a lot about this over the years.
Well, yeah, let's talk about that. Amazon's impact on climate, not just the carbon cost of shipping everything around and flying everything around, but also all those packages, all those boxes, you know, sometimes they can be recycled and sometimes they can't.
Right. And even now on Twitter and social media, he's being criticized for the heavy packaging of Amazon boxes. And it's also the energy that is used to power all the computers in the data centers, you know, not only Amazon's own data centers, but remember, Amazon's one of the world's biggest providers of cloud internet service to other companies, Amazon Web Services. So there's a lot of pressure not only on the transportation, but also on every way the company interacts with the environment.
So how big of an impact could $10 billion have on climate change? According to the Chronicle of Philanthropy, less than 3% of global giving goes to fighting climate change. In the U.S., climate change receives only about $500 million annually.
You're right. When you just think about that number, $500 million in donations annually compared to $10 billion that he's pledging here. So, you know, he could double the amount of philanthropic donations to fighting climate change for the next 20 years, even if it was spread out that far along. It's also important to imagine this number in perspective compared to, say, the entire Environmental Protection Agency in the U.S. Their budget this year was only $9.1 billion for the year. And President Trump, obviously, year after year, has tried to slash that even further. He wants to cut it to about $6.7 billion next year. You know, he hasn't had much success in cutting the EPA budget. And obviously, the EPA does a lot more than just research climate change. But just to give you a perspective on how much this is compared to what else is being done in the world.
The Jeff Bezos donation is going to be more than the entire budget of the Environmental Protection Agency. That's pretty amazing.
That's pretty big.
Mike Regan, senior editor at Bloomberg News. Thank you, as always.
Thank you, Jeremy.
Hundreds of residents in central Mississippi have not been able to return to their homes after days of heavy rain and flooding. In the capital of Jackson, the Pearl River crested yesterday at 36.8 feet, the third highest level on record. More heavy rains are expected throughout the night, and forecasters say some areas could experience flash flooding, making the situation much worse. Turning now to another story about water. Throughout the United States, water scarcity is a big concern. According to a study published in the Journal of Earth's Future, by 2071, it's estimated that nearly half of the 204 freshwater basins in the United States may not be able to meet the monthly demand for water. One alternative source is through a process called desalination. That's when salt water is converted into fresh water. The state of California recently approved $34 million for 8 desalination facilities across the state. But for most, this process can be expensive and could have a huge impact on the environment. Joining us now is Megan Motter, a research director for the National Alliance for Water Innovation. She's also an associate professor of civil and environmental engineering at Stanford University. Megan, welcome.
Thank you.
So converting salt water into fresh water, on the surface, this seems like such an easy fix to the problems of water scarcity, but it is not easy. It's actually a pretty complicated process. Can we start first with the sheer cost of desalination? It's sometimes, I'm reading, 2 to 4 times as costly as traditional options of water conservation.
Yes. So the technology that you use to desalinate really dictates the cost, but broadly, 2 to 4 times, 2 to 10 times the cost of traditional freshwater sources is somewhere in the right ballpark.
Yeah. What are some solutions to bringing the cost down?
So some of that cost is associated with the embedded energy of simply separating salt from water. In fact, thermodynamics is going to limit the amount of cost reductions or energy intensity reductions that we could be expected to achieve solely through technology innovation. Hmm. Instead, the National Alliance for Water Innovation is really built on the premise that to drop costs and to reduce energy intensity, we need to look at the broader network of water management in order to drop those costs. So broadly, the costs of managing water are the combination of the costs of treating water plus the costs of distributing water and collecting wastewater. So one of the things that we're really excited about is moving from a paradigm in which we are sourcing water from the sea or from freshwater sources, using it once and then discharging it, to a paradigm in which we are using water desalination technologies to enable a circular water economy with a great deal of distributed desalination and fit-for-purpose reuse.
Mm. How far along is this industry in that process, the latter process?
So our technologies today are really built for large-scale desalination installations. And we're really not yet able to do small-scale desalination at a cost-effective level.
The other argument against desalination on a broad scale is that it's bad for the environment and human health. I'm just curious from you, what are some ways that desalination could be more environmentally friendly on this large scale that you're talking about?
There are many aspects to sort of environmental impacts of water treatment broadly and desalination in particular. And so we believe moving towards this distributed desalination and reuse paradigm, where we're deploying desalination at a smaller scale, will actually help us get around a lot of the environmental impacts of desalination in a couple of ways. It'll drop the overall energy intensity of that combined treatment and distribution. And second, novel ways of managing concentrate at smaller scales will help us avoid the need to do lots of seawater desalination to augment supply.
Hmm. At Stanford, you focus on policies around this issue, and you recently got substantial funding for your research with the National Alliance for Water Innovation. How does the urgency of climate change propel you and your research to find solutions?
Yeah, so climate change is a real motivator for a lot of my work. We both expect climate to have a lot of impact on freshwater availability, both the amount of water that's available, but also the timing at which that water is delivered or naturally stored. And, you know, I think the other thing that we need to think about is that the process of decarbonizing our electricity system or our energy system is itself going to require lots of water treatment capabilities. So growing biofuels would require water. Storing carbon in the subsurface will require that we treat produced brines from subsurface storage. And so thinking about the water and energy system as deeply connected is a real motivating factor in my work. Underlying that is a tremendous need for new desalination technologies that integrate well with the electricity system. For instance, we can think about electrified treatment trains that can actually provide demand response services to the grid, as well as a set of technologies that can support the specific treatment needs associated with that decarbonized economy.
Do you feel that municipalities in the U.S. should wait to open up these desalination plants until researchers can fine-tune how they operate better? I'm just thinking about this desalination has now kind of been hailed as a possible solution to so much when it comes to water conservation and water crises throughout the world.
I think it's very important to think about seawater desalination as one part of a much broader water portfolio. In the same way that we don't rely solely on solar PV panels to provide electricity, we shouldn't be thinking about relying solely on next generation desalination facilities to provide water. Mm-hmm. Having desalination facilities does provide a very important function to municipalities, though. It provides a source of water supply with great reliability. So, you know, it's not subject to drought, to changes in fluctuations and precipitation, changes in snowpack up in the Sierras, et cetera. And of course, what I'm saying is very California focused, but it applies all across the country where some years you have higher water supplies and some years you have lower water supplies. Desalination is more costly and is more energy intensive than those traditional sources. But it provides resiliency to municipalities that isn't provided by some of these more traditional water sources. I do think that building in that resiliency is of critical importance for municipalities. I think it's also critically important for municipalities to think about other sources of resiliency. So as you mentioned, that could be through water conservation. That could be through ensuring the safety and longevity of water storage. And that could be through supporting water reuse inside of the municipalities, whether at a very local level by specific industries or more broadly within the municipality through wastewater reuse. Mm. So there are many different sources that can help to provide resiliency. I think seawater desalination provides a tremendous amount of resiliency value, and it also has the effect of capping the price, you know, for which municipalities are willing to pay for water. So they're not going to pay more than it costs to build, maintain, and operate a seawater desalination facility.
Megan Motter is Research Director for the National Alliance for Water Innovation. She's also an Associate Professor of Civil and Environmental Engineering at Stanford University. Megan, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Researchers have confirmed that the fatality rate of COVID-19 is much higher than that of influenza. More than 2% of people diagnosed with the disease have died, compared to a fatality rate of around 0.1% for the flu. But health officials in the U.S. point out that because the flu is so widespread, it kills as many as 60,000 Americans each year. And as Kerry Goldberg from WBUR reports, the flu is particularly bad on college campuses.
Back in 2009, Lillian Chasen celebrated her graduation from Barrington High School in Rhode Island with family and friends.
If I can aspire to be anybody, it's all of you together in one big bundle.
No.
So happy graduation day.
No.
The 18-year-old went on to the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, to pursue her interest in drama and won the lead in a college play. But just before Thanksgiving, she got sick. She felt tired and short of breath. Her father, Eric Chasen, says his daughter went to the school's health center.
They didn't recognize how severe it was. They told her to go back to her room and just wait it out because she was probably getting the flu.
The H1N1 flu pandemic was in full swing.
And the worst thing they told her was, don't come back because, you know, you're probably going to get worse. So if you feel worse, just understand that's the problem.
But Lillian got much worse, so weak she couldn't climb back up into her loft bed. Chasen says her mother, Kate, begged Lillian to go back to the health center.
And Lil said, no, I'm a big girl. They told me not to come. She wasn't old enough to know there. Sometimes you have to disobey.
2 days later, a relative brought Lillian back to the health center. She was sent straight to the emergency room.
By the time she got to the hospital, her lungs were filled with fluid, and she was basically, it was like drowning. She was no longer able to breathe for herself, and she was on a ventilator.
Her lungs were so damaged, even a ventilator wasn't enough, and her doctors took a desperate measure. Lillian was put on a machine that bypasses the lungs and circulates oxygen directly into the patient's blood. Day after day at her bedside, Chasen says, there was time to think about what went wrong and about how, at orientation, parents had been told it was time to let their kids go and trust the university to keep an eye on them. That trust can be particularly hard when it comes to flu, says Dr. Adrian Randolph, an expert on severe influenza at Boston Children's Hospital.
How do you monitor these kids when they're off laying in their dorm rooms and nobody knows that they're not able to breathe easily and that they're not taking in any fluids and that they have a really high fever and maybe they're just sleeping all day? So nobody even knows how sick they are.
Because of the fact that college students are considered adults and are emancipated, it is a challenge.
Dr. John Nguyen is the executive director of Harvard University Health Services. He says college health services know students are often handling their own health for the first time, and they may not prioritize it or know when to worry, so education is a must. For example, the end of a visit for flu would include warning signs to watch out for.
If you are finding that your shortness of breath is concerning to you, if you are not producing urine, if you have a high fever that does not respond to the typical treatments like taking a Tylenol, those things are worth talking to someone.
Dr. Randolph says when flu turns severe, it's usually because the virus suppresses the immune system and allows bacteria that live in our upper airways to invade the lungs.
And causes secondary bacterial pneumonia. And when that happens, that is highly associated with worse disease, ICU admission, and fatality.
Lillian Chasen spent 21 days on the lung bypass machine. At that point, her family was told the machine was causing too much internal bleeding and there was no more to be done. Eric Chasen says the doctor gave them a chance to say goodbye.
He offered to turn the sedation off so she could wake up, but we said no, that would just be too cruel.
Lillian Chasen died on December 16, 2009. In a statement, the University of North Carolina says it's committed to promoting wellness and has made changes since Lillian's death. Among them, if a student who visits the health center is short of breath, they're told to make an appointment to come back in, and a nurse follows up within 24 hours. Only a tiny percentage of flu patients die, but so many people catch the flu that last season the official death toll was more than 60,000 Americans. Dr. Randolph from Boston Children's says severe flu can strike even healthy people. The flu vaccine can help. It isn't perfect,
but it's the only thing we have in trying to prevent the severe cases.
Until Lillian got so ill, Eric Chasen says he didn't take the flu seriously.
When she was first sick and my wife was frantic, I'm like, it's just the flu. You know, it's not that big a deal. And of course, she was right.
He recently published a memoir that chronicles Lillian's illness and her life. It's called Breathless. For Eric Chasen, Lillian remains a perfect 18 forever, frozen in time, in memories he cherishes. On Facebook, he also shares a video of her singing a Beatles song for her mother's 50th birthday by a crackling fire. For Here and Now, I'm Kerry Goldberg.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Tanya Mosley. This is Here and Now.